This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baghdad wasn't the easiest place to keep a heavy metal band together. Not exactly the preferred music of the Saddam Hussein regime. But for the musicians we're about to meet, things got a lot worse after the U.S. invasion and the insurgency started, and so did the death threats from Islamist insurgents. Even wearing a Metallica t-shirt could put your life at risk. The documentary Heavy Metal in Baghdad is about one of the first and one of the few bands to perform heavy metal in Baghdad. The group is called Akrasakauta, which is Latin for Black Scorpion. The movie was shot in 2005 and 6 in Baghdad. It also follows the musicians after they crossed the border into Syria when the death threats became too much for them. Heavy Metal in Baghdad will premiere on the Sundance Channel Thursday night. My guests are two members of the band, drummer Marwan Rayad and lead singer and rhythm guitarist Faisal Al-Talal. Also with us is the co-director and producer of the documentary, Sarush Alvi, who co-founded Vice Magazine Publishing. After making the film, he helped relocate the members of the band to the U.S. Before we hear the band's story, let's hear what they sound like. This is Underworld from a demo they made in Syria. Music from the Iraqi heavy metal band Akrasakauta. And welcome, Marwan Rayad, Faisal Talal, and Sarush Alvi. Tell us what first got you interested in heavy metal music, which there probably wasn't a whole lot of in Baghdad. Faisal, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. We basically loved foreign music, so heavy metal was the road to us to explain more of our feelings, explode that kind of rage inside us, and try to find its way, dig its way, you know. But that wasn't enough for us as fans or listeners only. So, but basically, we turned our horses to more educational and more training as a band. Try to feel this music more and more.
Marwan, was it hard to find heavy metal records in Baghdad? I'm sure there weren't a lot of maybe there were record shops that had big heavy metal and death metal sections in it.
Well, we don't want to be a bad influence or something, but there was a lot of bootlegs and that was a good stuff, cheap stuff.
And did the bootlegs have the covers on them and everything?
Well, sometimes, no, you don't get lucky, with the cover. So what we used to do is just, write the stuff down on paper and just, put it with the tape. I mean, we didn't have CDs. We had the tapes, cassettes, and or somebody, will travel outside Iraq and come back with, a collection of stuff, heavy metal, rock and roll, Dio and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And we'll just copy them and this is the way that we just trade between each other. So it was kind of hard. It was kind of also fun, the whole process of it was epidemic, spread around and everybody will get to hear it. And sometimes by the time that you get the tape, you can't really listen to a good quality. It will be well, still good. You still can head back to it.
Let me ask you to talk about a song that you recorded after you left Iraq and lived in Syria briefly, and you were able to make a demo record in Syria. And one of the songs you made was called Massacre. It starts out in Arabic. Would you explain what's being said at the beginning of this recording?
Well, what's been said is like about the innocent people getting killed, rivers turning to blood, since like, you know, we had like two rivers in Iraq and stuff. And it's kind of, it has nothing to do just like about the images that we have to live daily in our lives, you know. Sometimes something bad happens in your life that you can't just get over it. You know, you'll dream about it. You'll think about it the whole time, you know. So we're just trying to get this off our backs by hopefully, like, if we do that, these songs, mostly like as a tribute for the people who just like, you know, got killed or whatever in the war. So we're saying like, you know, basically like, you know, these innocent children, innocent people, elders and seniors, like who got killed. And some people, like a lot of people got killed in vain, you know.
Well, why don't we hear the song Massacre? So this is the Iraqi heavy metal band Akrasakauda. And there's a documentary about the band called Heavy Metal in Baghdad that premieres on the Sundance Channel Thursday.
منذ أعوام مضت تدعو أسلوبا جديدا بقتل الأبرياء الأطفال الشيوخ والنساء قنابل تسقط كالمطر من السماء امتلأت الأنهار بدماء الأبرياء
Danger devolution, the joy of devolution. Massacre for generation, and the devil is still waiting. We want a death, rest of future. The same is yours, even much more than they want. War, and war is true. All you got, you gotta kill that beast.
It's a train.
That's the song Massacre by the Iraqi heavy metal band Akrasakauda. And the members of the band are now living in the United States. Two of the members are my guests, Marwan Rayad, who's the drummer, and Faisal Talal, who's the rhythm guitarist and singer. Also with us is one of the two filmmakers, Sarush Alvi. And Sarush Alvi's documentary about the band, Heavy Metal in Baghdad, premieres Thursday on the Sundance Channel. Let's talk about what it was like to play heavy metal in Baghdad before the American invasion. Let's start with the Saddam Hussein era. Did the government disapprove of heavy metal music? Did you have to play it underground?
This is Faisal. Basically, the government didn't disapprove anything back in the time. Most of the rumors come ahead from old friends and the people who surround us, because we had to, as an advisor from our friends, to translate all the lyrics that we used to sing, just in case, and be prepared that somebody would ask us or tell us that what the hell that we're writing about, or describe that the music that you're expressing.
I mean, no. I think I'm going to jump in here. And
go ahead.
I think
this
you
is
guys should talk
Sarush,
about
the filmmaker. Yeah, go ahead.
Sarush, who has nothing to do with the you know, writing or playing the metal in Baghdad, but they wrote a song called "Youth of Iraq" that they don't like talking about. And I'm going to force them to talk about it.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this. Yeah, this is a song that you. It's explained in the movie that when you did a concert under Saddam Hussein, you had to do a tribute to Saddam, a musical tribute to Saddam. So you did one. That's in the movie.
Yeah, it was an opening for a concert. Thanks, Sarush.
It's their dirty little secret. They don't like talking about it, but it's in the movie. So.
You're evil. You know that.
Just to make it more evil, let me quote one of the lines from the song.
Yeah, sure. Be my guest.
Right, okay. And this is about fighting the evil forces. And the line is, "We're following our leader, Saddam Hussein. We'll make them fall. We'll drive them insane."
Yippee.
So did you?
I love that song.
Did you write that just for this concert so that you could have your shout out to Saddam Hussein, or did you change the lyric of a pre-existing song?
No. Actually, like the whole thing is like just like Faisal said before, it's just through like our friends who like had bands before, like played gigs, we're kind of like intimidated by the situation down there. So we're kind of frightened because it's the first concert. So they told us, like, you know, maybe we should take precautions and just, like, you know, write something to the government. Some of us, like, you know, proved, some of us disproved the whole thing. But I guess the song came to be, and we played it twice in two concerts. Then we quit playing it. I guess it's much more like, you know, in order, like, you know, to play your music, you got to do some stuff that probably you need to be flexible. You need to go with the flow, which is not good all the time, but we had to do it. And
no, I understand. You know, and it is catchy.
Plus, like, it's a, no, plus, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, the guy who wrote the song is not, like, no longer in the band now, but, like, the lyrics. But what I'm saying is, like, sometimes it means a lot for us to play our music.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
you know, like, for the last, like, you know, years, like, you know, we've been doing whatever.
Well, since there's a scene of you performing it in the film about you, Heavy Metal in Baghdad, why don't we listen to an excerpt of that performance, of your tribute to Saddam Hussein. And what's the song called again?
Youth of Iraq.
Youth of Iraq. Wow. Okay. Here it is. And this is the band Across the Kauda. That's the band Across the Kauda. They're an Iraqi heavy metal band that managed to get out of Iraq, and the band members are now living in the United States. My guests are two members of the band, Marwan Rayad and Faisal Talal. My third guest, Sarush Alvi, is the co-director of a documentary about the band. The film is called Heavy Metal in Baghdad, and it premieres on the Sundance Channel Thursday night. So we were talking a little bit about playing in a heavy metal band while Saddam Hussein was in power. Let's talk about what it was like after the American invasion, when there was a civil war, and a lot of the insurgents were ultra-religious Muslims, many of whom like didn't even like music, let alone heavy metal music. So and Americans were really hated by, or maybe I should say are really hated by, a lot of Iraqis, and heavy metal is so associated with American bands and with American popular culture. So did all of that, did the religious fundamentalism and the hatred of America affect your ability to play heavy metal music or even to wear your favorite T-shirts?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, totally. I mean, it was already, like, dangerous, like, forbidden, like, to play such kind of music. I wouldn't say forbidden, but was just, like, just too eccentric, you know. But, of course, after the invasion became a matter of life and death, and does it really worth it? Does it even worth it that you're playing music and you're threatening, you're jeopardizing your life and your family, too, with that, you know?
Was it so dangerous? I mean, I know it was dangerous just to be outside, no matter who you were, but why was it particularly dangerous?
Well, it's first, we're singing, like, in English, mm-hmm. you know? So they considered that, like, Americanized. Second, it's rock and roll, so that's also Americanized, you know? Third, it's, like, you know, the way that we dress, the way that they can see us coming back and forth from the practice space and you know. Well, obviously, we weren't going to the practice space wearing man robe or something or turbans, you know. So it was kind of like, you know, we were kind of distinguished, but in a bad way. So that's the thing. So we received the threats and saying that we're Americanized.
So how would the threats be delivered? Like, would someone tell you, we're going to kill you if you keep playing your music? I mean,
Well, you know, we found them hanging on the store walls, like, you know, the front door for the
practice space.
Yeah, practice space. We found them there.
Right.
And it was like pieces of papers and you know, written and just hanged there. So
here you are trying not to call attention to yourselves when Sarush shows up to make a documentary about you, and suddenly there's cameras following you around. Sarush, were you worried when you went to Iraq to make the movie that you would endanger the band?
Well, when we first went, our original idea was that we wanted to spend a day in the life with these guys and see what it was like from breakfast to evening to playing a concert. And as soon as we got there, we realized just how impossible that idea was. And we weren't following the guys around Baghdad. It was just far too dangerous for them to be seen with us. So we were forced to meet at locations that Faraz would choose. And it was all completely on the DL. And we're never in seen in public together.
And Sarush, you're Canadian. You live in New York, but you're of Pakistani descent. So you don't necessarily look Canadian or American. And until you open your mouth, you could pass maybe as Iraqi or from the region. Did that help you, do you think?
I think so. I think it did a little bit. And Eddie, my co-director, he's Italian Canadian, and he can pass as Iraqi as well. And that's the thing that Faisal and Faraz were saying when we were there. They were like, "You guys look Iraqi. You just have to start walking like Iraqi guys. Just walk like you've never been more tired in your entire life."
Yeah, except for the flag jacket that you were wearing.
Well, we practiced in the hotel room because we were starting to go stir crazy. We were in there for a week and being told we couldn't walk around in public. So Eddie and I were determined to go walk around in public. So, Faraz and Faisal kind of put us into training, and they said, "Okay, pull your shirt out, put some dirt on your pants, wear flip-flops, and just drag your feet as you walk, stare at the ground.
Cigarettes in one hand.
Yeah, smoke a lot of cigarettes, and then you'll be fine." So that was our
camouflage.
Sarush, you and your co-director helped organize a concert for the band at the Al-Fanar Hotel in Iraq. So there's scenes of this concert in the movie, and the audience, I mean, it's a relatively small audience because it's in the ballroom of the hotel or something.
Yeah.
But people are so into it, and everybody's kind of, doing the headbanging thing and making this, falling on each other and, doing the devil horns. They're so into it. But from what I could see, there wasn't one female in the audience. So I was wondering, is it because the music didn't appeal to women, or is it because women just couldn't go out then? Or, what accounts for the fact that there were no females?
It was too dangerous
for dangerous?
Them. Yeah. Basically, the whole tradition wasn't, so acceptable for a woman to walk alone in the street or having boyfriends or something, just, not so liberated. Neither to say that going to a dangerous spot that we performed at that night, which is basically it's near to the Sheraton and Palestine Hotel, which has been surrounded by concrete blocks and Americans all over the place and the whole security guards. So they check the whole Iraqi IDs and search the whole T-shirts, scanning machines, and all that stuff. So an Iraqi woman wouldn't bother to go through all that process just to see heavy metal. I mean, yes, they do exist. A lot of listeners. I'm having a lot of messages on MySpace or Facebook or whatever, they're just expressing their feeling that they wish to come at these concerts, but they couldn't, and they wish they could seen us before. So at this point, I feel glad about it, just all these years I was imagining there's no scene of metal to women, but now just everyone started coming up, and now it's really growing.
It's funny because, certainly in the United States, so many musicians say they became musicians because they thought they would be more appealing to girls if they were in a band.
Sex and drugs and
no, exactly, and exactly. And of course, here you are in Iraq, where girls can't even show up to the concert, so it's not going to be very helpful in that area.
It's more like bomb and war and rock and roll for us.
Yeah, no, exactly, exactly.
I guess.
You said for you it was like war, bombs, and rock and roll. In this concert that we've been talking about, there's a power outage. There was a mortar that goes off next door or something. So,
yeah.
So
it's part of the scene, actually, just like fireworks, So it's much easier to do such stuff in Iraq.
You did kind of get used to it in a way, didn't you? I mean, you seemed kind of unfazed by it in the movie.
No, I guess it's all going to be overrated if we say, like, we got used to it. No, you can never get used to such a stuff. Like bombs, I don't think nobody can get used to it. But you just, like, you know, it's part of, like, basic human survival, I guess. You have to survive, you know. So you have to go, like, wake up every day and you have to go to work every day. And, you know, you can't starve, so you can't get used to it. But you can deal with it, I guess.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about what it was like to be in a heavy metal band in Baghdad. My guests are two members of the Iraqi metal band Across Akouda, drummer Marwan Rayad and lead singer and rhythm guitarist Faisal Al-Talal. The band is the subject of the documentary Heavy Metal in Baghdad, which will be shown on the Sundance Channel Thursday. Also with us is the film's co-director, Alvi Sarouche. After the insurgency started, the band started getting death threats from Islamic extremists. So eventually, you and the other members of the band decided to do your best to get out of Iraq. Two members went first, the other two followed. Can you tell us why you wanted to leave and how difficult it was to get out? You went to Syria first.
Let me just rephrase this before.
The
general idea of us leaving Iraq is not like because we wanted that so desperately. I mean, most of people could miss it or misunderstand it, but we've been forced to leave. And leaving all this behind was so hard. It was so depressing for us. We wanted to do something for the band. And for me, I mean, at my time when I wanted to leave, I had already two members of my band had already left to Syria.
How long were you in Syria and how long were you in Turkey?
Well, a year and a half, I guess, like 3 years overall. I can't be exact, but I guess it's overall like 3 years.
Did it feel like freedom in either of the places, or were you in such difficult positions that you still didn't really feel?
Well, you need to understand we're refugees, so it's life like just it's a hard life. Multiply it like in 10 times, I guess, like because a lot of bureaucratic stuff that you need to go through, paperwork, just to legalize your situation, and just to, you know, a lot of people got the bliss, like, you know, to born in their countries and walk tall and stuff. For us, it was. Even that was kind of hard, so we had to go like through down streets and alleys just to avoid like being in like misunderstanding situation or get caught by the police, because sometimes we're illegal in these places because the paperwork wasn't done.
Well, I guess the general idea wouldn't. I mean, things was getting really harder and harder, and we were out of time, out of money, so we had to do what we had to do.
And what did you have to do because you were out of money?
We made heavy metal in Baghdad.
Yay.
We said yes to whatever solution. Any,
you
know?
You hadn't said yes before that?
I don't know.
Not in our Baghdad, you know.
I think it took some time to gain the trust of these guys as well, and the whole, you know, process of making the film. But once the film was out and premiering at the Toronto Film Festival, that's when the Syrian government was getting fed up with, you know, the number of Iraqis that were coming in, were threatening to kick Iraqis back in to Iraq. And at that time, the guys were receiving threats from inside of Iraq when they were living in Syria. So because of the footage that we'd shot and put on our website on vbs.tv, I'm not sure if that makes sense. But what happened was that we had kind of outed these guys. They're living their lives as refugees in Syria, and all of a sudden they're getting threats for their music from inside of Iraq. People saying, you know, come back home. We'll take care of you. Meet us on this corner at this time in this city. So the guys are contacting us saying, the Syrian government's about to kick us back home, and going back home is a really bad idea. What can we do?
The situation wasn't stable, too. You know?
Yeah, so that's when we started raising money.
Raising money to get them out of Syria?
To get them out of Syria and get them to Turkey. Turkey was the one country that you could fly to as an Iraqi without a visa, and they would accept you. That was the one border that was kind of open at that time, and even that had a window that was going to close. So we hustled and, you know, raised awareness, and the metal community donated.
That was the craziest thing ever.
Yeah, donated, you know, whatever, 25 grand or something like that. And with that, we got them tickets and some cash in their pockets when they landed.
It's great. So there's like metal community around the world. It's really great. Sarush, when you decided to make this documentary about this Iraqi heavy metal band, did you have any idea that suddenly you'd feel responsible for their lives, that their lives would be endangered in part because of the movie, and it would be on your head in a way? Yeah. Go ahead.
Absolutely not.
Oh, yeah. Keep talking. Keep
Terry,
talking.
Had I known, I never would have made the movie. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
No, you know, it was just, we were just chasing the story, and it just kept going, and it was something that started off as the story in the magazine and then became a short form
epidemic.
You know, yeah. Webisodes on the website, and then it turned into a feature. And then once, you know, the credits rolled at the end of the film, the story kept going. And that wasn't something that we had expected or bargained for, that it would have repercussions like that. And so that's why we stayed involved. And at that point, we'd also developed a relationship with these guys and were friends and just wanted, you know, they asked for help. So
a lot.
they you want to say that? Never stopped.
So now Turkey isn't the end of the story. Sarush, you helped get them with the contributions from the heavy metal community. You helped get them into Turkey, but now you guys are living in the United States. Was Turkey a problem eventually too?
No, we needed a place. Okay, we couldn't stay like in exile forever. We couldn't stay like unstable forever. Mm-hmm. We couldn't like walk and we're carrying like the forms of refugees, like 3-4 papers around. You know, you need to understand it's refugee. Being a refugee is not a status. It's just like, you know, form. You know, it's part of a process. You know, and that's why that it was just like, you know, it wasn't the destination. So we had to go to some place where we can perform our music, where we can play our music. It didn't matter where, just like, you know, we had to find a solution. And I remember we applied, like, with help from the Vice, we applied to the Canadian embassy twice, got rejected, and the German, because, like, embassy where they were premiering Heavy Metal in Baghdad, the movie, and they helped a lot, but just the papers, I guess it was a problem with our paperwork. Then it just happens that we got to the States and you know, and it took a while. We came to here like separately, you know, like individual, like separately. Till like I just got here like a month and a half ago.
Oh no, I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
the level of bureaucracy, as an outsider looking in, seeing what these guys had to go through in Turkey was totally insane. We've actually filmed something called Heavy Metal in Istanbul, which was not to just keep pushing, you know, movies that I make about these guys, but it was kind of covered their story in Istanbul. But we filmed the entire process with the UNHCR that they had to go through.
That's the UN Commission, High Commission on Refugees.
Yes, in Ankara, in the capital of Turkey. And we interviewed the people at the UNHCR there, and they were saying, you know, the psychological impact that this amount of bureaucracy has on refugees, it really takes its toll. And it, you know, the system on some level doesn't make sense. They, even once they became, you know, official refugees in Turkey, they weren't allowed to work legally, and then were forced to resettle in these satellite cities all over Turkey. So the band was then broken up, and they're all living in 4 different cities inside of Turkey, and they have to check in with the local police stations every week for, you know, X number of months until they can be granted exit visas out of the country.
Yeah, until they finish the process.
Because Turkey doesn't want Iraqis to stay there indefinitely. It was kind of like a temporary station. They want to resettle the refugees in another country. And so that's why, you know, we got
population.
We got the IRC involved, who are the International Rescue Committee. They're an NGO based here in New York, who got behind their cases and helped expedite everything and got them resettled.
In the United
States? Over the last couple of months, yeah.
Yeah. So you're all living in New Jersey now.
No, yeah. We're just separated. Some in New York, some in Michigan, some in New Jersey. Also scattered again.
Oh, but I didn't realize that. So one member of your band is in Michigan?
Yeah, for now. I mean, like, just because we can't afford, like, you know, I mean, the crisis right. of the economy a little bit affecting us.
So you finally made it to America, but you can't play together right now because you're not together.
Yeah, we made it here to hustle.
So what are you doing to make a living and to pay your rent?
Working different jobs, waiting tables mm-hmm. and whatever, you know, overtime jobs. But, you know, you need to understand the main reason for us is the music to be here. Working with the Vice on finding something and solutions. But everything's taken, like, you know, a while, you know, finding instruments, finding practice space.
Finding instruments. You know. Did you not have your instruments when you came?
Oh, we had to sell them all so we can afford, like, you know, whatever tickets, pocket, like money for our pockets and stuff. So we had to sell our instruments.
Do you have them back yet? Do you have new instruments yet?
We didn't earn money yet to have them back, you know? No, not yet.
Some of the, you know, companies out there like Fender Guitars have been really supportive in the past. And Yamaha just gave a bass to Faraz and... You know, James Hetfield gave his guitar to Faisal.
This is James Hetfield of Metallica. And if you want to see him giving the guitar to Faisal, just go on YouTube. Because it's on there. It's a really sweet moment.
Yeah, for those who doesn't still concerning about the whole situation, I'm still in coma, okay? I'm still in coma. Yes.
So have you been to any heavy metal concerts in the United States? I know you can't afford food, but have you managed to get into any concerts?
Yeah, I mean, like, we can't afford tickets, but, you know, the Vice is helping kind of like getting us like mooching
right.
tickets.
So talk a little bit about the experience of being in a heavy metal concert in the United States compared to what you were used to.
It's great seeing the amount of people and on the whole benches are full and people standing and people going through the mosh pits and the stuff. I mean, you don't see that every day like for us, you know. And it's great seeing like a big community of metal heads and metal fans and standing on that solid ground and the bands performing. And it was a great show. I mean, like, it was kind of like an epiphany for us, like, to see all these stuff. And just to remind us about what we're kind of miss the most, which is music and perform on stage. I mean, like, we had 600 people on stage and we were like, you know, yeah, we had 600 people on stage and yeah, whatever, you know, and now, like, I just go to an underground concert and there's like, you know, 1,000 like of people and watching like an underground band. So it's great. I mean, like, we're kind of being optimistic considering the music, trying to work hard just to catch up because, it's been the last 2 years. I mean, like, we didn't really, you know, continue with our music because we had to handle all the paperwork and just like we said, the bureaucracy stuff.
So I'm sure you'd love to be in that position of being on stage in America with thousands of fans in the audience.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Just all like, over the globe. You know?
Just like when I was trying to talk to the guy and telling them, just like, guys, seriously, for the first time, we're fit in the whole society. I mean, the whole guys was metalheads and headbangers and all these hot chicks and around you. And all. So just like was really... really interesting to see all that, you know, just like, yes, but I want this.
But here's the thing, like, now you finally fit into this large community of fellow heavy metal fans and musicians, but you're still the outsider because now you're an Iraqi in this American community. So, like, you're finally with your people, but they're not quite your people.
See, to be honest, it doesn't matter mm-hmm. for these people, like, you know, music does matter.
Mm-hmm.
Paperwork and that says, like, where are you from and stuff. I'm like, we speak the same language. We speak the language of the music, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it sounds kind of, like, cheesy or cliche, but this is the way it is.
Right.
We went to this festival in Atlanta, and there was, like, 31 bands performing. And we were, like, surprised to see how much people knew about us and knew about the movie. But they knew about us, and they were, like, you know, really delighted and with, like, you know, wide open arms saying, like, you know, we want to take photos with you guys. Are you playing today? So I don't think it does matter. Borders and frontiers and stuff doesn't matter. It doesn't make sense in the music, like, world, you know?
Let me ask you this. It seems to me you're in a kind of funny position where on the one hand, you have this, like, documentary about you being this Iraqi band that plays heavy metal. And the documentary is about to be on Sundance, Thursday night. It's played film festivals. It's gotten good reviews. So, I mean, you have in some ways, you know, you're kind of semi-famous or semi-semi-famous or semi-almost famous. But at the same time, it's like
you need to find a category.
Yeah, you need to find a category. At the same time, you're almost semi-homeless. I mean, you know, you just got to the United States. You have no money.
Paradox, huh?
Yeah, so you're living in kind of both worlds at the same time. You don't even have instruments yet, you know? That's how little money you have. So it must be a really awkward, kind of ridiculous time for you.
It is. I mean, like, a lot of times we just, like, you know, you don't know if you have to laugh or cry or because, yeah, I mean, like, we go and we see ourselves and there's, like, hundreds of websites and talking about the band and you know, whatever, and talking about the documentary and being, just like you said, the whole, like, buzz about the movie. And on the other hand, you know, I didn't, like, you know, I've been, like, couch surfing for 6 months now. So that's the thing. So, yeah, we're living this kind of, like, living paradox. Like, you know, are we famous? Are we not? Are we homeless? Are we musicians? Are we musicians? Are we refugees?
I'm interested in how you feel about America now. Here's what I'm thinking. You know, the American government decided it wanted to, like, you know, bring democracy to Baghdad and ended up bringing civil war to Iraq. And you became victims of that. You had to flee the country because of it. So that might go in the negative column for you, for America. And part of the reason why you had to flee is because you were playing a music that came out of America, heavy metal. And America was so hated in Iraq then that you were threatened. And now you're living in America. At the same time, you're broke. It was hard to get in here. It's not like America invited you to come. I mean, it was really hard for you to get in.
I already feel better when you say, like, the whole story, you know? Like, you're, like, reminding me of this, and it feels good.
So, but how do you feel about America now? I mean, like, what are your thoughts about the country?
It's not easy. It's not easy as it seems. It's a lot more complicated if you want to, like, just, like, you know, and want a program or show, like, trying to describe, like, two nations' policies and politically views and you know, you can't do that. First, like, we're musicians. And second, I guess what happens in a lot of points was monstrous and you can't justify it, you know. But also we can't justify, like, the First World War or, like, the second one or, like, you know, all over. I can't justify the goal for or trying to analyze it or explain it because, you know, we had our head in the music. But I would say, like, you know, killing living souls and stuff, that's wrong, you know. And this is against everything. And we had to go through that and we had to live through that. And I guess we got lucky in a way, you know, if you look at it. A lot of people got killed in these wars, and a lot of people just, you know, had to live with a lot of, like, you know, living, like, the daily sorrow of missing someone or, you know, part of their families,
even
part of
here,
their lives.
Even here, a lot of families lost their own kids and sons and daughters in the army, I mean, over there. Just, like, it isn't fair, you know. Both societies been destroyed.
Well, that's what we're saying. Like, we can't justify war. I mean, like, if you expect, like, two musicians just to come and talk about war, like, you know, I wouldn't, like, drag myself to that.
Yeah.
But I would say it's monstrous, it's hideous, and we don't want to sound hippies, but, you know, wish there was peace on Earth, but I don't think this is possible.
Well, Marwan and Faisal, I want to wish you good luck with your lives and with your music. And Sarush, congratulations on the movie, and thank you for talking with us. It's been a pleasure to talk with the three of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marwan Riyad and Faisal Talal are members of the Iraqi metal band Across the Kauda. Sarush Alvi is the co-director of a documentary about the band called Heavy Metal in Baghdad. It will be shown on the Sundance Channel Thursday. Actress Isabel Gillies made her debut in the movie Metropolitan and went on to a recurring role in the NBC crime series Law and Order Special Victims Unit. But she gave up acting to move to Ohio, where her husband had landed a job teaching poetry at Oberlin College. What unfolded there, says book critic Maureen Corrigan, was a crime of the heart.
I swear to you, this really happened. 2 weeks ago, I was sitting around on a Saturday night, just me and the dog. I didn't feel like reading any of the books I was supposed to be reading, so I began rooting through my pile of new review books. One slim volume caught my eye, initially because of its title, Happens Every Day, a memoir by Isabel Gillies. What happens every day, I wondered, and so I started reading. I couldn't put the book down, and by the time my husband came home late that night from a business trip, I'd finished it. I grunted, "Welcome home," and went up to bed, drained. The next morning over breakfast, my husband looked up from the newspapers and announced, "I finished a whole book last night." "So did I," I said. You see the punchline coming. He'd picked up Gillies' memoir from the table where I'd left it, and he couldn't put it down either. Maybe it's a bit ominous that we both were transfixed by this account of a marriage abruptly falling apart, although certainly we bonded all that morning by trying to figure out why Gillies' memoir is so disarming, especially given that she's not a writer. But therein lies her charm. When Gillies, for instance, starts reminiscing about the restored Victorian house she and her husband and her two little boys lived in Ohio, and then just gives up after a few sentences and says, "I will never be able to write how great it was," you smile, you're on her side. That amateurish snort of frustration with words not only gives Gillies' story the ring of truth, but it also ironically conveys what a polished description might not, that this was one fantastic house. Similarly, as Gillies tackles her main subject, the sudden disintegration of her marriage, you feel, as a reader, as though you're sitting with a good friend over a pitcher of margaritas, listening to her tearfully, digressively, even ditzily describe how her husband, whom she knew since they were both children spending summers on an island in Maine, turned practically overnight into a pod person. I'll fess up to the fact that Gillies' beauty, she was on the cover of 17 magazine, and she had a couple of dates with Mick Jagger, adds a bit of schadenfreude here for the rest of us mortals. Even beautiful people get dumped. And it's a double bonus that this whole sad story takes place within the fenced-in groves of academe, and that Gillies' then-husband is a professor-poet. Think Heathcliff with an earring, she tells us. It's always fascinating to read about academics acting on their ids rather than their intellects. The gist of Gillies' tale is this. Her husband, whom she calls here by the pseudonym Josiah, wins the academic jackpot, a tenured teaching position at Oberlin College. Gillies, by the way, offers very funny, outsider takes on the preciousness of artsy colleges like Oberlin, describing it as a school where all the students play an instrument well and know how to address transgendered people. After the first year, they bought that great house, and within a month of moving in, Josiah fell head over heels for a woman Gillies calls Sylvia, the new hire in his department, a half-French Audrey Hepburn lookalike whom Gillies had befriended. Another entrancing aspect of this painful story, as Gillies tells it, is that Josiah refuses to discuss his obvious infatuation with Sylvia. This is a man who's a poet, whose brilliant mind one friend likened to a cathedral, and yet in this crucial situation where his marriage and family are at stake, he acts like 90% of the guys out there and won't talk about his feelings. Gillies, of course, desperately wants a story to explain why her life is upended. Finally, months after they separate, he calls Gillies and announces that he and Sylvia are indeed a couple. I know we're only getting one side of the breakup here, but unless she's a much more manipulative writer than I'm giving her credit for, Gillies comes off as a genuinely peppy, uncomplicated woman. She even admits that she doesn't really like poetry because she just doesn't get it, which obviously might have created problems with Josiah the Bard. For those readers who have endured similar seismic shifts of the heart, Happens Every Day will offer the comfort of solidarity. For the rest of us who've been so far spared, it makes for compulsive and, frankly, chilling late-night reading.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Happens Every Day by Isabel Gillies. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Menjivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.